Hello. It's December 5th, 2024. My name is Simone, and this is 90s Crime Time. Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. And if you're new to 90s Crime Time, welcome to the show. Like always, I hope you all had a great weekend and are having a great week so far. And I don't have too much to say about today's episode beforehand, except that listener's discretion is advised because this episode may be a little graphic for some. And it does touch on the subject of racism through the eyes of the suspect. You also may have heard of this story, but I wanted to bring it to you anyway. And with that, let's dive in to today's case. The year was 1993. And in the New York suburb of Garden City, New York, many people here enjoyed a mostly great way of life. Reports state that here in Garden City, many families lived in plush homes surrounded by a mostly garden atmosphere, and their children attended the best of schools. Garden City was also known for housing the largest mall in Nassau County, as well as one of the largest malls in the country, Roosevelt Field. And also around this time, Garden City was home to 5 train stops on the very busy Long Island Railroad system. Reports state many commuters traveled from the area day and night trying to get to their destination. And it was one of the busiest rail systems in all of New York. However, in December 1993, as thousands of commuters were riding the LIRR, little did they know a certain passenger that day was mad at the world and wanted to let their voice be heard. And when they expressed their feelings that day, there would be carnage. In the following case, you'll find out what event happened on the LIRR, the investigation, and the aftermath. In a case I title, Terror on the Tracks. On December 7th, 1993, hundreds of commuters boarded the Long Island Railroad train system at around 5:30 p.m. to travel on the 5:33 p.m. train that left Penn Station in New York and dead-ended into Hicksville, New York. As it was rush hour, many suburban workers were anxious, tired, and ready to go home. The commute went reportedly smoothly as normal until around 6 p.m., when some commuters had not reached their stop as there was a delay. Reports state many of these passengers who were scheduled to get off at a stop at around 6:08 p.m. vented their frustrations and wondered what was happening with the train. After the train stopped completely at the Maryland Avenue stop in Garden Park, Long Island, passengers from as far away as the 8th car of the train had no idea why they stopped there. But soon, the passengers saw emergency personnel come in droves to the stop. And from a distance, they could see panicked passengers towards the front of the train run and have looks of terror on their faces. Then, once the passengers and cars towards the back realized they would not be going to their next stop anytime soon, they exited the car onto the platform and then made a horrible discovery. many of their fellow passengers of the 533 had been brutally assaulted, and they later learned they had been shot. As emergency personnel tended to the victims on the platform, the passengers of the 533 watched in horror as badly injured passengers were being brought out, as well as the dead. And after a while, they witnessed the man who was behind the sinister plan being brought out after his reign of terror stopped. And his name was Colin Ferguson, age 35. According to reports, Colin Ferguson was born in Kingston, Jamaica on January 14, 1958, to Vaughn Herman and May Ferguson. And reports state he was born into a life of privilege with his four brothers. His father, Vaughn, was a very successful pharmacist and the managing director of a large pharmaceutical company. Due to his wealth and status, Vaughn was known as being a part of the wealthiest circles in Jamaica and socializing with many government and military officials. It's unclear what Colin's mother May did as far as a career, but what is understood was that she was a doting and loving mother to her sons. The Fergusons raised their sons in a gated and large estate in a suburb of Kingston, fit with maids and a nanny, and they made sure their sons had the best. Growing up, Colin attended some of the finest schools in Jamaica, was well-rounded, and his extracurricular activities included playing cricket and soccer. In 1974, Colin graduated from the prominent Calabar High School, where he graduated in the top third of his class. After he graduated, Vaughn got Colin a job at the pharmaceutical company. But just a few short years after things were continuing to look up for Colin, his world came crashing down when in 1978, Vaughn was killed in a car accident. Colin was crushed as he looked up to his father and depended on him for a lot of things in his life. Even worse, his beloved mother May died the following year of cancer, devastating him. And according to reports, the family finances. You see, reports state that after May passed, and it's unclear how exactly, the family's finances started to dwindle rapidly, and Colin struggled to make ends meet as an adult. After not being able to depend on what little money they had left, Colin's brothers dispersed to live with relatives or take jobs in other parts of Jamaica. However, Colin became a little disgruntled about the lack of opportunities in Jamaica and decided to take a leap of faith at the age of 24 and move to the United States. Reports state Colin first arrived in Miami on a visitor's visa in September 1982, and later that year he moved to Long Beach, California, for reasons unclear, to try and rebuild his life as he did in Jamaica. But to his dismay, Colin eventually settled on a job working at a liquor store. And according to reports, this was where people around him started to notice something was up with him. Reports state that when he worked at the store, many of his coworkers and even the owner of the store described him as having a chip on his shoulder and frequently complained the work at the store was beneath him. However, the owner reported he was still hardworking and well-spoken. A security guard at the store said, though, He was uncomfortable around Colin, especially when Colin would allegedly openly claim his hatred of other races and even some Black Americans. Reports also state that after about a year of working at the liquor store, Colin quit without explanation, and by 1985, he ended up in Long Island, New York. By this point, the people who knew Colin in the States and his family back home had hoped he would fare better here, especially after he met a woman named Audrey Warren and eventually married her in 1986. Reports state that after he married Audrey, he gained permanent U.S. citizenship, and the two eventually had a son. But soon into the marriage, it was anything but a fairy tale. According to reports, shortly after Colin and Audrey got married, they would argue frequently, and their fights would get so intense sometimes that the police had to be called. Outside of the home, Colin worked odd jobs around Long Island, but he did eventually enroll in Nassau Community College as a part-time student, studying accounting and business administration. However, reports state he received a low grade in one course and was forced to leave another after a disciplinary hearing found he had been overly aggressive toward the teacher. Despite this setback, Colin wanted to continue his studies at Nassau, but by 1987, his failing marriage prevented him from doing so. And by 1988, Audrey sued for divorce and won custody of their child, with reports saying Audrey divorced Colin due to being too aggressive and having different views in life. For Colin, the divorce was another crushing blow. After the divorce, Colin moved into a basement apartment with a male friend, and they too argued frequently. By late 1988, he got a clerical job at a security firm, and it was finally steady work for him. But in 1989, while standing on a stool pulling invoices from a filing cabinet, Colin slipped and fell, suffering injuries to his head, neck, and back, which eventually led Colin to be terminated. He filed a claim for workers' compensation disability benefits, and after several hearings, was awarded $75 a week judgment settlement. However, a report states this was not good enough for Colin, and he tried to reopen proceedings with the New York State Workers' Compensation Board. His reason? Colin claimed that he was a victim of racial prejudice and rejected state-appointed doctors sent to examine him because their surnames sounded ethnic and not Black. Due to his frequent arguments regarding his case, which included writing and calling obsessively to the board, reports state Colin was put on a list of possible troublemakers security guards at the board were to watch out for, which went on for several years. Also by this year, Colin re-enrolled at Nassau, and this time he made excellent grades and made the dean's list by 1990. He received high praise from his instructors, and after receiving enough credits, he transferred to the local Adelphi University, majoring in business administration. However, again, despite having his life look upward, reports state his fellow students and staff witnessed Colin continue to talk frequently about racism and his disdain for white people and other minorities. Reports even state Colin grew incensed and yelled at a professor when she talked about her symposium to Saudi Arabia. He continued and said the professor should have talked about the racism in South Africa at the time, and he complained that a white woman in a student library had shouted racial slurs at him. The professor found these claims to be untrue, and Colin claimed he was undermining Black people and later threatened him. With the threat, the professor recommended to the school leaders that Colin be suspended. Colin also called some fellow black students Uncle Toms and allegedly told a black professor that, quote unquote, black rage will get you. Colin even snapped in another class and yelled, quote unquote, kill everybody white. By 1991, after hearing about more of Colin's outbursts, he was suspended from the school, but was allowed to reapply in the next school year. But he did not do so. Instead, reports state, Colin moved to Brooklyn. Here in Brooklyn, Colin lived in a very small, menial apartment with very low rent. To the people who were around him here, they described him as very neatly dressed, but that he kept to himself and rarely smiled or spoke to anyone, except occasionally to say hello. His landlord described him as respectful at first, but felt he blamed his problems on everyone else, especially white people, who the landlord said he blamed for holding him back. By 1991, he was also still unemployed, and as he was trying to find work in Brooklyn, Colin's anger was still festering due to his lack of luck. One report states his frustrations blew over, though, when in 1992, he shoved a woman over a seat on the subway. He was also still suffering from pain from his work injury and was seeking more money. And after a series of hearings, a report states, quote unquote, the State Workers' Compensation Board on September 21st, 1992, approved a settlement in which he was awarded a total of $26,250, including $4,800 in weekly benefits he had already received. Again, though, reports state Colin was still unsatisfied, and by April 1993, moved to reopen the case, claiming he was still having pain from the injury and needed more money. However, after possibly realizing a new application would take forever to be seen or even decided, Colin, fed up with New York, moved back to Long Beach, California. When he got back to California on April 22nd, he desperately tried to find a job. He was even said to have tried to find a job at a car wash, but when he applied, staff there allegedly laughed at him. And after this, Colin truly snapped. His anger got the best of him, and he was over it. Reports state that the same day, Colin checked himself into a cheap motel where the staff found no issue with him, but noticed he didn't hang around the motel too much during the day, mostly at night. The next day, on April 23rd, Colin went to Turner's Outdoorsman, a gun shop in nearby Signal Hill, and put down an $82 deposit on a 299 15-shot semi-automatic Ruger pistol. Reports state Colin, quote-unquote, gave his legal name, supplied a California driver's license with his motel's address to provide residency, filled out a form affirming that he had no criminal record, and waited the required 16 days before returning, paying the balance due and collecting the weapon. After his gun purchase was complete, Colin went back to Brooklyn, where his landlord noticed him talking in the third person frequently, and he would quote a lot of black activists, twisting their words and insinuating that mistreated black people would strike down their oppressors. Months later, in September 1993, reports state Colin was notified by the Workers' Compensation Board that his application for reopening his case was being processed. However, again, Colin did not want to wait for a long process and obsessively wrote the board pressing the matter, and even called the board up to three times a day. The board did not usually reopen cases, but since they knew Colin would press the matter, they granted his wishes. However, reports state the board gave Colin a list of board-certified doctors again and told him to go for a medical reevaluation while he waited for a decision by December 1993. But he refused, and the board denied his new application. Angry, Colin began calling the New York City and Albany offices of Governor Mario Cuomo and Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundine to complain about his case, again around 3 or 4 times a day. And after getting nowhere, Colin became very distant. The few friends he did have in New York barely saw him, and his landlord, who frequently witnessed Colin pray, noticed he stopped doing so. The landlord and neighbors also noticed Colin would have his shower on multiple times a day and hear him allegedly chant, quote-unquote, "All the black people killing all the white people." Uncomfortable with him by this point and thinking he was suicidal, his landlord asked Colin to leave by the end of December. However, by December 7th, 1993, Colin decided his fate and not to wait until the end of the month to leave. He wrote some notes, got dressed, and left the apartment with his gun. Reports state that he traveled to Penn Station in Manhattan and boarded the 5:33 p.m. train going eastbound towards Queens. Once he got to Queens, Colin boarded the third car of the eastbound Long Island commuter train that was to dead end into Hicksville, New York. Reports state, as the train continued to the Marillion Station in Garden City, Colin drew the gun, dropped several cartridges on the ground, stood up, and opened fire at random. At first, his fellow passengers didn't know what was going on with all the popping noises. But as people began to bleed and drop, they panicked and began to duck and scramble for cover. With one person shouting, quote-unquote, "He's got a gun," and another yelling, "This is real life, everybody." Some passengers in the same car as Colin began to flee from the car into other cars and locked the doors behind them as they did so Colin could not follow them. Train staff were eventually alerted and alerted the conductor of the train, but the conductor did not want to stop in the middle of the track. As Colin continued to fire at random people, he exclaimed with a blank stare, quote-unquote, "I'm gonna get you." When he finally ran out of ammunition of 2 magazines, and as he was attempting to reload his gun again, someone yelled, "Grab him." And then 3 brave passengers, Michael O'Connor, Kevin Blum, and Mark McEntee, tackled him and pinned him to one of the train seats. Several other passengers ran towards to grab his arms and legs and helped to pin him across a 3-seat row with his head towards the window and legs towards the aisle. Bizarrely, though, as he was pinned, Colin exclaimed, quote-unquote, "Oh God, what did I do? What did I do? I deserve whatever I get." He also pleaded with those pinning him to not shoot him and apologized. Meanwhile, passengers in other cars wondered what was going on as passengers from the third car approached them, screaming. And once the train stopped in Garden City, they finally got a clear picture of what was happening. A report states a lady passenger was able to call her husband, an off-duty police officer who was waiting for her at Marillion. And once the train stopped at the platform, the officer rushed in and handcuffed him. As emergency personnel worked on the injured, word spread like wildfire across New York about the shooting, and the press sped to the scene, as well as anxious family members of victims hoping their loved ones were okay. Later they would learn Colin injured 19 people and killed 5, with the 6th victim dying 5 days later. Passengers and loved ones of victims were also visibly and audibly upset as they witnessed Colin sitting in the back of a police car, looking like he had no care in the world. As the hours went on after the shooting leading into the next day, people from across New York and now the country read about the carnage Colin caused, and his face was painted on many front-page newspapers. By the next day, detectives told the press that during his initial investigation, they found notes in his pocket that apparently gave his reasons for committing the carnage. On one note, Colin blamed racism on Caucasians and Uncle Tom Negroes. On another, he said he did this to get back at the woman he argued with over a subway seat in 1992. On another note, he blamed this on the Workers' Comp Board. He also blamed Asians, Governor Cuomo, and several civil rights leaders. He also showed no remorse during his questioning. Colin was arraigned on December 8, 1993, but did not enter a plea. He was also denied bail. By December 11th, his court-appointed attorney requested Colin receive a psychiatric evaluation to try and prove an insanity defense. However, by December 18th, Colin asked a judge to replace his attorney with an attorney who had a reputation for pursuing allegations of racism in the criminal justice system. This attorney even offered to represent Colin pro bono, but the attorney withdrew his offer after having conflicts with Colin. By January 1994, a report by a court-appointed psychologist and psychiatrist concluded Colin was suffering from paranoid personality disorder, but was competent to stand trial. By January 19, 1994, after 3 days of evidence presentation, a grand jury handed up a 93-count indictment against Colin, which included aggravated harassment, second-degree murder, attempted second-degree murder, and criminal possession of a weapon. Until his trial began, Colin frequently complained about his treatment in prison, claiming correction officers attacked him with milk crates and a fire extinguisher while depriving him of necessities like soap. Colin was also reported to have been assaulted numerous other times in prison, which again he complained about, and he was said to have been taunted by correctional officers many times, which he complained about as well. Over the next few months, Colin went through several different attorneys until he dismissed all defense counsel and decided to represent himself, to the dismay of the court and seasoned attorneys. Colin's trial finally started on January 26, 1995, and in the courtroom, Colin wore a bulletproof vest under his suit. During his opening arguments, he stated that as the commuter train made its way out of New York, he had dozed off, and someone had stolen his gun and opened fire on the passengers. He then said in third person, quote-unquote, "Mr. Ferguson was awakened by the gunfire and amid the confusion sought to protect himself." He then told the jury that the charges against him were a racist conspiracy. However, the prosecutors laid the blame on Colin and produced several items of evidence against him, including police photos of victims lying in pools of blood, as there were shell casings and bullet holes in the railroad car, to which Colin objected and said they were prejudices, but the judge overruled him. The pistol wrestled from Colin was also used as evidence. As prosecutors passed the weapon back and forth in front of the jury, Colin objected when he was not allowed to hold the gun. In response, the judge sent the jury out of the room. Colin then motioned to have a mistrial, but the judge denied the motion. Colin argued that the 93 counts that he was charged with were related to the year 1993, and had it been 1925, he would have been charged with only 25 counts. He eventually admitted to bringing the gun into the train, but claimed he fell asleep, and another man grabbed his gun and began firing. He also argued about a mysterious man named Mr. Sue, who had information concerning a conspiracy against him. Colin also was said to have found another man who was willing to testify that the government had implanted a chip into his head, but decided not to call the man onto the stand. Also, when he would question witnesses, Colin would force the witness to repeat testimony already given. When a witness refused to answer the question the way he liked as well, he would often ask the judge to quote-unquote admonish the witness to answer the question. Colin would also frequently question witnesses, saying quote-unquote, "Did you see Colin Ferguson?" followed by a question. Reports state, after being asked this, witnesses would respond with responses such as, quote-unquote, "I saw you shoot me." Colin then claimed during the trial that the Jewish Defense League was conspiring to kill him and said that the prison murder of cannibal serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer was a rehearsal for his death behind bars. Colin also originally sought to question himself on the witness stand, but ultimately did not do so. He told the judge and media that he intended to call several witnesses who would prove his innocence, including a ballistics expert, a handwriting expert, and two regular eyewitnesses, but they were afraid to come forward and take the stand. Ultimately, Colin did not call any of the witnesses and then rested his case. On February 17th, the jury deliberated the case for 10 hours, and when the jury returned to court, they acquitted Colin on 25 counts of aggravated harassment, but found him guilty of all the other charges on the counts of murder, attempted murder, assault, reckless endangerment, and weapons possession. After Colin was found guilty, family members of the deceased and the wounded victims filled the court to testify during sentencing recommendations and begged the judge to give Colin the harshest sentence. However, before he was sentenced, Colin openly accused the wounded of plotting with police against him, in which victims and their families turned their backs and filed out of the courtroom. But Colin continued speaking for more hours. In response, the judge in the case said to Colin, quote-unquote, "Colin Ferguson, in my almost 21 years on the bench, I have never presided over a trial with a more selfish and self-centered defendant. The vicious acts you committed on December 7th, 1993 were the acts of a coward." The judge eventually sentenced Colin to 6 consecutive 25 years to life terms, one for each count of murder. The judge also gave Colin 25-year sentences for each of 19 counts of attempted murder, for a total of 475 years. His victims and their families cheered as the sentence was read. Since his sentencing, Colin has appealed his conviction several times. In the aftermath of the massacre, many victims and their families sued the LIRR for failing to protect its passengers. But LIRR officials responded by noting that the rate of crime against passengers had dropped over the past few years before the shooting. However, the LIRR did place more officers on trains and increased the visibility of police in response to the shootings. One person involved in the massacre, Carolyn McCarthy, whose husband Dennis was killed in the massacre, and whose son Kevin was severely injured, also sued the ammo company that Colin used. Still, the suit failed partly because New York state law placed no responsibility on manufacturers for the criminal misuse of their products. However, Mrs. McCarthy was subsequently elected to the United States Congress on a gun control platform. In closing, in addition to the multiple victims who were injured that day, let's remember the 6 innocent souls who lost their lives on that fateful December day. 27-year-old Amy Federici, 51-year-old James Goriki, 27-year-old Mi Kyung Kim, 30-year-old Marita McToto, 52-year-old Dennis McCarthy, and 24-year-old Richard Nettleton. The story of the Long Island Railroad Massacre comes from the sources of Newsday, The Reporter Dispatch, Time Magazine, and others I'll put in the notes. All right. Thank you for listening to this sort of lengthy episode. I know some of you probably heard of this story of the Long Island Railroad Massacre, but I did want to bring it to you because this story has always interested me. I should have done it last year, but I got really hectic last year. Last year was the 30th anniversary of the massacre, and I should have done it then, but I brought it to you anyway this year because it's December, the same month. And I hope this story interested you if you had not heard of the story. I'm not going to do a long opinion piece because I've done a lot of the story in length. But I first want to say I apologize for any mispronunciations I've done for the story, especially pronouncing the train stop. I don't know if it's Maryland or Marion train stop in Garden City. Also, some of the names I may have mispronounced, I do apologize. But I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist or anything, but I do think something snapped in Colin. Maybe he already had some mental issues when he was growing up in Jamaica, living the life of luxury. But that all, you know, came crashing down and came out once his parents passed, which devastated him, which would devastate anyone. And he was used to a life of luxury. And once his mother passed, I don't know how, like I said, the money just went away and he was on his own with no resources per se. And then he moved to a different country. I'm not sure if he'd been to the U.S. before or had family there already. I'm not sure, but his brother stayed in Jamaica. He was alone. He got married. That didn't work out. He had an education in Jamaica, but got to America. Even though he tried college, it didn't work out. Odd jobs didn't work out. He finally got one job that was decent, got injured, got fired. Got the money, but it wasn't good enough for him. He was still in pain. It just went all to hell for Colin, and he unfortunately took it out on other innocent people. And I don't know why he chose the train. I know he had those, you know, scribblings and notes about who he blamed, but he never really mentioned, from what I've read, why he chose this train, why he chose commuters, passengers on a train to take out. I guess he couldn't, you know, I don't know if he was trying to, you know, kill politicians, because like I mentioned, he was against some civil rights leaders and some New York politicians. I don't know if he was trying to hurt them. I don't know. But maybe it was easier to get to passengers, obviously, to make his voice heard. But it's just all sad, and innocent people lost their lives, and Colin is in prison for life, which he should be. Some people I read thought maybe he should be in a mental facility, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think I think he was part mentally insane, part angry. So I think he's where he should be, which is in prison for the rest of his life. And that's it. Thank you for tuning into this brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. And again, I hope you were interested by this episode. If you have not already, please leave a rating and maybe a comment telling me what I could do better. I know I've had this show for a while. I am trying to do better. I also apologize. There's possibly some barking dogs in my neighborhood. I don't know if you all can hear them, but I do apologize for them. They're acting a little crazy right now. I should be back next week with another new episode. Like I promised, I will try to have new episodes until the end of the year, excluding Christmas, though. I'm going to take the break for Christmas week this year. But with that, stay safe and healthy, and I'll see you soon for a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time.